Welcome back to Weed Like a Word, part two with Dougie Brimson. I'm Paul Waters and...
I'm Stephen Colgan.
And we're talking about getting working class writers into publishing. And Dougie, this is something that's very important to you. So what sort of challenges or barriers have you... You've been slagging off bookshops in part one. Have to say, I love bookshops. It's him. But... when it comes to publishing itself, what have you come up against?
Don't get me wrong, I like bookshops. I love trawling around the bookshops. But as an author, as an author in my market, they're not doing me any favours.
But playing devil's advocate, as you said earlier, is your audience the sort of person who would go into those bookshops?
They would if they had... Most of them wouldn't go into bookshops because most of my audience, readership, I should say, are crammed into a little corner under sports.
Yeah.
And so they've got very limited sports books in general are increasingly limited to autobiographies, which I find really irritating.
Trust me, the same's happening with me. I work in comedy and you try and find comedy novels these days. Almost impossible.
Yeah. I mean, and even I've done two comedy novels and they've, as soon as they see my names, and Waterston's as guilty of this as anybody, as soon as they see my name on the cover, they stick it straight into the sports thing. Well, they're not necessarily sports novels.
Well, what about publishers, though? What about publishers?
I think the big problem with publishers, I mean, we've just had this report out, the Common People Report. It came out 1st of May, I think. And when I read it, I thought, finally, something is going to be done to start giving opportunities, not just to working class writers, but to get working class people involved in publishing, be it as commissioners, as editors, or whatever. And within days, all talk about, the working class writers hashtag, it all dried up. And I think the big problem for them is that they don't get working class readers. They don't know what that readership wants. And it's safer. It's safety first, especially at the moment when, they're all potentially under a cosh. So all you're going to get is more of the same, because more of the same is safe. And all you've got to do is look at Twitter, and it's an endless stream of chicklit being promoted by chicklit bloggers, promoted by female PR agents, female agents, female commissioning editors. Publishing seems to me to be almost dominated, that level of publishing seems to be almost dominated these days by females. And for your average working class bloke, it falls to guys like me to give them what they want. But there's so much more for them. And I think the biggest problem of all, and the biggest issue, which I've never really got to grips with, is there's this, as I'm proving on a daily basis, there is money to be made from this market. If only you knew what to give it and started delivering. And yet, as far as I can see, there is no intent to do so.
Well, just coming back at you a bit, I mean, it's true that publishing is overwhelmingly staffed by women. I think in the UK, these are old figures from a couple of years ago, but there was a survey and it was 84.6% women, and even more than 90% white men and women. And in America, it's the same, about 78% women, 79% white. Now, I suppose you could say, well, fair play to all these women if they like certain types of books. If they like Marion Keyes, great. They're buying it. Women buy books. This is what they want. Fair play to them. And if people want to share their joy and share the knowledge and spread the word, great. Well, maybe it's up to people who like what you write to spread the word and prove its popularity, because they're not going to turn their noses up at making money.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. And I, I read as much chick lit as any other bloke, really. I've read my share, more than my share. But the point is, and it comes back to the one fundamental point, that the most important person in publishing is the reader, because they're the end, they're the end. And without them, you haven't got an industry. And yet there seems to be this ongoing dismissal of a large section of an audience that, as I'm proving, they'll read a product if you give them the right product.
What do you think about, I was reading Kit DeWall was saying that there's this assumption that there are only maybe three working class stories. So the misery memoir, the escape, and like the clever boy or girl done good. And she was saying that if you go beyond those, it's difficult to get people to, I suppose, to take your books, to publish your books, to listen to you. So she's editing this compilation of working class writing in Britain. And there's a kind of a sister version of it that Paul McVeigh is editing of working class writers in Ireland. He's a working class writer from North Belfast. The Good Son was his book, which is really good. It was published by Salt in the end. So there do seem to be people trying to make a noise and make an impact about this.
So working class blokes don't do romance. They don't do heartbreak. They don't do depression. They don't do all of these things. And they just do these three stories. And that's why you've got a problem. That kind of narrow thinking is why we have this problem. You know, I just find this baffling, this kind of dismissal of this large market. If they're serious about this whole working class writers thing, if they're serious about reaching this new readership and bringing all these people back into indie bookstores, why aren't they talking to people who are out there actually doing it? Because I can't, no one's ever spoken to me about it, apart from guys like you. If I contact an agent, I still haven't got a literary agent. I've never had a literary agent because I've never found one that wants to represent me. Even though I'm out here selling books and writing movies, I've still not got a proper book deal, which is why I indie publish. When you've got a 61-year-old guy pitching a book about, you know, a football lad to a 26-year-old girl named Sarah, you've got no chance, absolutely no chance. So you just don't, you just give up and don't bother. And it works easier for me. You know, I mean, this is like, I know this sounds like a complete whinge fest, but I do what works for me and I'm quite happy it works for me. What annoys me is the fact that there are so many other authors out there who are not getting a break because of this narrow-minded thinking that's running through publishing like a cancer, as far as I'm concerned. It's tragic.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like I said earlier, I can see a real parallel with this with comic novels, because I grew up reading comic novels. I grew up reading Douglas Adams, you know, Tom Sharp, George MacDonald Fraser, I mean, Michael Frayn, David Nobbs. We had some of the best comedy writers in the world writing brilliant TV shows, brilliant radio shows, fantastic novels. In the last, well, probably since the millennium, really, in the last 20 years, it's dried up. All these people who I looked at as the great comic writers, they've all died, and there's been no replacements. And I've heard similar sorts of arguments to the ones you've put, given to me by people in the industry and other writers, that, well, unfortunately, the commissioning editor was a middle-class 20-something woman who just didn't get my sense of humour. Now, I understand that humour is a very tricky thing anyway, because it differs from person to person, and what one person finds funny, 10 other people won't. But nevertheless, trying to get a novel... I've got a literary agent, a very good literary agent, and he hasn't been able to sell a single one of my comedy novels for the last 6-7 years, simply because the commissioners say, well, it's very funny, very well written, but I don't see that there's a market for this. Well, there's never going to be a market unless you put them out there, you know?
Exactly, and that's the pinch point.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started writing, publishers would still take risks on stuff. They took a risk on us, albeit a calculated risk. And it worked, Headline were the only publishers we approached for the first book, and they bit our hands off, largely thanks to the brilliant editor we had at the time, Ian Marshall. But the whole thing seems to have changed, where you've now got this pinch point where you've got commissioning editors almost as if they're saying, well, I'm only going to publish what I want to read. And they don't seem to be able to connect with the outside of that spectrum, if you like.
If you look at the bookshelves, though, they're full of books written by men, not necessarily comedy novels, Steve.
No.
But there's no shortage of male authors being published. So somehow they're getting through this female barrier that you're talking about.
Yeah, but most of that, if you look at most of them, you know, a large section of them, they tend to be very traditional stories in the sense that they're either spies or military based.
Yours is actually, getting back to In the Know, it really reminded me of a book I read when I was very young called The Churchill Commando by Ted Willis. Have you, obviously there are differences. Oh, there's vigilantes, although in his one it was ex-military, which isn't quite the same as you. I'm not sure, Ted Willis, is that the same Ted Willis of Dixon and Doc Green? Steve, you know these sorts of things.
Oh, I don't know, actually, yeah, it could be.
Anyway, the book gets slagged off a lot because I guess it's on the side of the vigilantes. And one of their targets, though, are football hooligans. In your book, the football hooligans are kind of the good guys. In this one, the first target of these vigilantes is they punish football hooligans who are terrorising communities. And it all goes wrong. I suppose that's the acceptable way. They hurt the wrong people. Mistakes are made and it falls apart. Although in your one, the conspirators and the vigilantes have a happy ending. And I thought you were quite harsh on the journalist there. I mean, there were dodgy journalists, but they all did fine. It was kind of the honest journalist came to a bad end. I don't want to say too much. That I suppose it depends on your politics. You might think it was a happy ending or a sad ending.
I think it was a thought-provoking ending. That's what I wanted to do. Because I always write the endings first, you know. So I know exactly where all my characters are going to end up. I know exactly what's going to happen to them. Everything else is about getting the reader to that point. I knew the ending I wanted because I knew, and if you've read it, you know what happens at the end.
I do.
I'm not exactly a fan of journalists. I did get a perverse pleasure in putting him through some of the things I had to put him through.
Dougie, you were saying you write the end first. Is that the ultimate in plotting then?
Well, I don't know. I never trying to be a writer. You know, well, you've read my stuff. You probably know that. For me, it's all about the story. You know, everything's driven by the story. I'm a firm believer in the fact that you can teach someone to write, but you can't teach someone to tell a story. But every story is about the ending. And most of my books will come, the idea for them will come from an idea for an ending. And I'll always write the ending first. I'll get it quite tight. So it's pretty well formed. Only once I've done that, will I go back to the beginning. Then I'll kind of pantser the rest. Pants them away through a vomit draft. And as I'm doing that, I'll start to develop my characters and the scenes and whatever. But I know the point I'm coming up to. I know the point where that character's got to get to at the end. And nothing frustrates me more than seeing someone who's written 60,000 words and says, you know, I don't know how to end this story. Well, what on earth? You haven't got a story then, because if you haven't got an ending, your story's not fully formed. So if you write from an end, if you write the end first, and you know that point, you can do whatever you want to do with your characters. You can take them off on any tangent you want to do, as long as you know you've got to bring them back and where you've got to bring them back to. And it works. It works for me anyway. And everyone, you know, my readership seems to like it. They all like the twists I build into stories. And it does allow you to build a good twist into the end.
In this one, it's set kind of today. Your book, In the Know, is set today. And Brexit has been voted for, but it hasn't quite been put into action yet, which is where we are at the minute. It's still in the transition sort of phase. Yeah. Boris Johnson gets a mention. Jeremy Corbyn gets a mention. When did you have the story? Did you have the story and then think, I have to sprinkle some contemporary names in, or did you write it all quickly? Yeah.
You know, I had the idea for the story. The initial idea was for a different story. It was for a movie about 6 or 7 years ago. Then I had another idea for a different movie shortly after that. And these were two banged together. And then Billy was brought in and all his backstory. And the book is actually set in 2018. So they've just had the vote and all that sort of nonsense. Everything's been messed around. You know, whatever your politics, it kind of reflects one side of the political conflict that was going on at the time. It continues to go on, to be fair. And so I wanted to make it as honest as possible by bringing in certain references to specific events without getting too journalistic, if you want, because that's not what my lot want. They just want the story to bang, you know, to bang along. So if you've got a reference to Boris, it's a very brief reference to Boris. on something that's happened, and then we're on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, because that's really all they care about. They just care about keeping that story moving. And again, that reflects when you write movies, you know, every scene is designed to move the story along, and I try and do that in my book.
Well, that brings us nicely to the end of part two. In part three, more of the same, and we'll also be finding out the answer to last week's question. So see you in part three.